WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writer's Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Someone when they have that revelation,
like the army freeze,
you need to make it
sure. How does this work as a national story?
Well, it's so Oakland, San Francisco.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
It's heating up, and recently, the topic of race has entered into campaign news. For a closer look, please welcome our black correspondent, Larry Wilmore. Larry, thank you so much for joining us. Larry? Okay, please welcome our senior black correspondent, Larry Wilmore.
Hey, John. Glad to be here.
Thank you, Larry.
The senior black correspondent on The Daily Show was a role Larry Wilmore was almost born to play. He's got a keen eye finding comedy in white America's difficulty when it talks about race, and somehow always seems to make an ass of itself. Last year, he became host of his own show, The Nightly Show, with Larry Wilmore. So he was a natural choice this year to appear at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, the very last of Obama's presidency. But his remarks there somehow caused a lot of concern among people who thought that in speaking too familiarly to the president, Wilmore had crossed the line. You were the speaker, the comedian, at the last White House Correspondents' Dinner for President Obama.
Speaker slash comedian, yes.
Tough gig. Tough gig. I think you told me before that you had had 80 jokes all set
sure,
to go.
Yeah.
And you had thrown out God knows how many.
Yeah, we started with a lot more. And, you know, you cut down, cut down. We ended up with about that much. And then I was editing as it was going along, too.
That's got to be nerve-wracking. And why are you editing? What's happening?
Well, once you realize the temperature of the room.
What was the moment that you did? And what was the temperature?
Oh, when I did the Wolf Blitzer joke. I think it was the Wolf Blitzer joke where I said, okay, I don't know if these people are on my train right now.
So what was the Wolf Blitzer joke?
It was connected to the joke before. So I did a joke about Obama enjoying his last year in office.
Saw you hanging out with NBA players like Steph Curry, Golden State Warriors. That was cool, yeah. You know, it kind of makes sense, too, because both of you like raining down bombs on people from long distances, right?
And Obama gave it at least a fake laugh
on that one. You know, one of those things, which I didn't see at the time. I saw it later, you know, which is fine, you know. I mean, he's supposed to do that. He's such a good sport, right? So the follow-up is, and speaking of drones, how is Wolf Blitzer still on television, you know? It's, you know.
He looked mortified.
Yes.
And pissed.
Yes. It came across as a statement of fact that I was taking a pause from the comedy routine and just stating this, like, this hard, cold opinion, which it wasn't at all.
The most controversial and electrifying moment, without a doubt, was at the end. So walk us through what you did at the end of the speech and the thought process that went into it, and then also Obama's reaction.
Okay, so that was something that I had thought of maybe a month earlier. I just kind of wanted to have a moment where I kind of summed up what his presidency really meant to me. And I've made jokes saying I vote for him because he's black and all that stuff, but there is meaning behind that joke. It's a proud moment that can't fully be expressed in words. Mm-hmm. And one of the manifestations of that feeling is pointing out to people, and it's ironic because I'm the same age as the president, is that in our lifetime, a black man couldn't be a quarterback. You know, people thought, what, a black man lead white people? That's impossible, you know, for a whole host of reasons that everyone agreed on.
And not so long ago.
Yes, that's my point. It happened in my lifetime. This is not something my parents told me. And then to see this man, you know, as I said, to live in your time, Mr. President, where, you know, black man's the leader of the free world. And actually, when I wrote that part down, you know, it was so emotional. I was like crying when I wrote it down, you know, because it meant so much to me. And, you know, the last part was just something that came out of a burst of inspiration. I just thought it was something that I just had to express that way.
Words alone do me no justice. So, Mr. President, if I'm going to keep it 100, yo, Barry, you did it, my nigga. Did it.
To me, that was having a private moment in public.
And how did the room, how did you feel the room reacting?
I had no idea. I had like an out-of-body experience at that point, you know.
And then you walked over to your right,
yes.
And you get a hug from the President of the United
yes.
States, and he says what to you?
And he kind of beat his chest, too.
That's right.
That I did, which was an amazing nonverbal response, because the nonverbal response could have been, okay, what did you just say?
When you look back on this presidency, forget policy for a moment, foreign policy, domestic policy, the way he has talked about and marshaled his own blackness and race has been an adventure, a very complicated performance in many ways. How do you, now that it's coming to an end, how do you look back on it? How do you think about it?
Yeah, it's an interesting way to put it, because the first incident was before he was elected. We had to answer charges about the Reverend Wright and those sort of things. And he gave that, I thought, a very great speech on race and spoke directly about it. And in his first year, the Skip Gates thing was the first time he kind of addressed something, and he had the beer summit.
When Henry Louis Gates, the Harvard professor, was
And
caught breaking into his own house.
I know, exactly. But that was kind of an awkward moment. It didn't seem like that was a moment that was truly owned or truly choreographed well. It was just weird. Why are we having a beer summit over this? You know, it just seemed odd, you know.
It did seem unplanned and unscripted, and there's actually a moment in the press conference where Obama's first asked about Gates' arrest, and I wanted to listen to that with you. I think it's a pretty good example of Obama's off-the-cuff sense of humor.
The guy forgot his keys, jimmied his way to get into the house. There was a report called into the police station that there might be a burglary taking place. So far, so good, right? I mean, if I was trying to jigger into, well, I guess this is my house now, so it probably wouldn't happen. But let's say my old house in Chicago. Here I'd get shot.
That's an amazing hard joke there. And
Press conference.
Yes. And first of all, and the president should know, brothers should never be trying to jimmy or jigger their ways into homes. That right there is a mistake. But what, that was an awful.
Show the key. Show the key.
I'm jiggering right now. Sorry, brother. You should not be jiggering your way into a house. But what an amazing joke about him trying to break into the White House. That's a pretty good joke, actually.
But you've talked about him as a comedian, and you pretty admiringly. What skills does he have, and how much of it derives just from the chair he sits in?
He has an incredible sense of timing. He's very likable. He learned how to pause. Like, comedians used to have accessories on stage, like a drink or a cigar and that type of thing, and that was to allow the audience to laugh. You know, like George Burns would take his puff of a cigar so you would laugh, not because he wanted to smoke a cigar on stage. You know, that's why Groucho had the cigar, right? So Obama uses his smile and his charm as his cigar, if you will, you know, and he's very good at it. He knows how to pause and wait, and the audience gets to think along with him, you know, and gets to enjoy kind of sharing a moment with him. What's interesting, though, is that when he's talking about policy, I don't think it works as well. You know, when
how
he's
so?
Well, he has a very deliberate approach, especially when he's
speaking. Hyper-deliberate.
Yes, when he's speaking extemporaneously, and I think that works against him. I think he would be better served if he was more succinct and more direct in some ways.
It's almost like when he's talking, it's like he's talking to be quoted. When I've had the opportunity
very lawyerly language.
Well, and when you interview him, when you transcribe an Obama interview, they're full written paragraphs. And it's not just because he's prepped. It's that's the way he is.
Yeah, he's writing his essay as he's talking to you.
Yeah, and he's self-revising in his head.
Yeah.
Nothing undeliberate pops out.
Yeah, I remember I did a joke a couple of years ago. I was like, Obama just takes too long to talk. I mean, if you just asked him what he had for breakfast, he'd be like, well, breakfast, there was some sort of decorative plate. It's like, I'm hungry. Come on, let's go.
Give me an egg.
Yes, if you ask Bush, it's like eggs. You know, it's just that quick. Some kind of sausage. You know, great. That's all we wanted to know. Thank you, Mr. Bush.
Who's the least funny president you can remember?
One of my time, it had to have been Nixon. I mean, arguably the funniest thing he ever did was he was on Laughing and said, "Sock it to me." But he was like, it was unintentionally funny. Gerald Ford, I know I'm going back so far. Gerald Ford was funny, but he didn't know why he was funny. Jimmy Carter wasn't very funny. Ronald Reagan was very funny.
Why?
He was a performer. He was an actor. He knew how to deliver a joke, mm-hmm. You know, and he was charming. Reagan had charm, and charm goes a long way. Reagan was funny on purpose and by accident. He was both. Obama's never unintentionally funny, which is interesting, because many presidents are usually unintentionally funny. I can't remember him being unintentionally funny. I think the only possible thing I can think of was when he tried to bowl that time when he was running for
office.
That
wasn't good.
Yeah, that's the only unintentional funny thing I can think about Obama, but there's not a lot of that, which is kind of weird. You know, you would think there'd be more.
So now you've got a presidential race where you've got Donald Trump,
yes,
the presumptive Republican,
right,
and you've got Hillary Clinton, who's
yes,
close to that, mm-hmm, and Bernie Sanders still hanging in there.
Right.
And you've got a show to do every night.
Yes.
And what does that present for you?
Gold. In Trump's case, maybe fool's gold. I don't know.
But in all seriousness, do you think that Trump and Trumpism is sure, the outcome of 8 years of Obama? How do you link them together?
Yeah, some of that is that. I mean, presidencies are either a continuation of the previous one or a referendum of the previous one. You know, the Trump presidency is certainly a referendum. I call it the unblackening, mm-hmm, you know, Obama leaving the White House. I mean, because here's a man who spent a lot of his time and resources and capital trying to question the legitimacy of this black man who is the president of the United States, you know, which I found very insulting. And now he says, make America great again. And a lot of people are following that.
And that phrase means what to you?
It's just very problematic, you know. First of all, it assumes that America is not great, which I don't agree with, you know. But it appeals to this narrative that Obama has ruined the country in some way, that he's taken away the thing that made America special, you know, his time in office. And I find that part very offensive, you know.
But, you know, you've been around, mm-hmm, New York long enough. You kind of go, mm-hmm, back and forth between L.A. and New York. And you,
yeah,
know that Trump in the 80s and 90s, mm-hmm, was kind of a figure on our, right, in our ego sphere. He,
sure,
was a kind of comic business figure,
right,
and he was complicit in the comedy almost.
There
was
completely.
There was a sense that he knew just how ridiculous,
right,
he was, and in order to keep his head above water,
yeah,
and his name on buildings, this is the role he played.
Yeah.
How did that get from that point to this point?
God, it's a great question. Who knows? I mean, I call him the leader of the upper crass, is what I say, you know. It's this it's this movement that only wishes to speak directly from the id and handle issues as shallowly as possible. And
he uses political correctness as the way in, that I'm not going to be politically correct, and then he says something.
He uses it as an excuse to insult people, which is that's not how you talk about political correctness. I mean, I would agree that sometimes our language can be too careful, but you don't break that down as an excuse to call John McCain a war hero, a loser, because I don't like people that get captured. That's your reason to break down political correctness? It doesn't make sense.
But I got to tell you, when that happened, mm-hmm, when the John McCain moment happened, this is now months and,
yes,
months ago, I thought to myself, well,
he's
can't
done.
That. Yeah, he's
right,
cooked. And,
right,
then there would be another one 2 weeks later, and,
yeah,
another one 2 weeks later, and his percentages only grew and,
yeah,
grew and grew, and now he's the nominee.
Amazing. Amazing.
Which tells you what? It tells you that the country is you know, the quick answer to this for a lot of people, I was watching Rob Reiner.
David, do you understand how fungus works? Do you?
Yes.
I don't. I don't get it. It just keeps growing. I mean, you try to attack it any way you want, and that fungus just keeps going, right? I don't understand why that happens, you know?
Now, how do you face the prospect of a Hillary Clinton presidency, comedically speaking? Mm-hmm.
Hillary is another person who's funny in spite of herself. You know, I've never seen Hillary funny on purpose, but she's very funny not on purpose. So she offers a lot of comedic material. Of course, you have the first husband possibility, too. I mean, there's so much comedic material on that side. So on both sides, there's – look, I have a lot to look forward to no matter what happens, you know, as a comedian, but in completely different ways.
You talked about how you felt in January 20th, 2009, which is the first inauguration of Barack Obama.
Right.
And – for all I know, you were there. I don't know, man.
I was.
Yeah, it's me too.
I was there with my family out
with a lot of coats.
Yes,
a lot of coats.
Exactly.
How are you going to feel January 20th coming up?
Man, that's a good question. I think, wow. I think I'll probably be a little misty, you know. Definitely the end of an era. To see the last black president, you know, go
well, this
away,
is it. That's, you know? keep it 100. Are you going to see another black president in your lifetime or mine?
I always thought it'll be more like Haley's Comet or Alex Haley's Comet, if you will. I don't know. you know, I'll be lucky if I see it streaking across the sky again. Who knows? It would be nice. But, you know, we'll see. We'll see.
Larry, thank you.
Thank you.
Larry Wilmore, host of The Nightly Show. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Coming up in a minute, a kind of fish-out-of-water story. A veteran from Texas, hardened by years of combat in Iraq, who found himself among kids half his age at an artsy liberal arts college.
I said, is it a good school? He said, yeah. I said, done. Let's apply. And then I said, well, where the hell is Vassar at? You know, I was like, I've never heard of that.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
James O'Keefe is a conservative activist known for his undercover videos that have embarrassed NPR, Acorn, Planned Parenthood. He recently had an operation go awry, and it exposed some of his working methods. It all started with a phone call. New Yorker staff writer Jane Mayer takes it from there.
The phone call came into the Open Society Foundation. Now, that's George Soros' group, which funds a lot of progressive causes. And it came to an employee named Dana Garrity.
It was, I believe, March 16th. It was pretty quiet, and I was just kind of hunkering down and getting through my work when I noticed that my phone was ringing, and a number I wasn't familiar with popped up, and so I let it go to voicemail.
Hi, you have reached Dana Garrity with the Eurasia Program at the Open Society Foundations. I'm not available right now, so please leave a message and I'll get back to you shortly.
Hey, Dana, my name is Victor Kesh. I'm
a Hungarian. It was a call from a Victor Kesh, who apparently was a Hungarian-American citizen who worked for a foundation.
I'm representing a foundation that would like to get involved with you guys.
So I was a bit kind of suspicious about that, because when you call, you identify the actual foundation you work for.
Fighting for European values and some other issues. And I'm an American citizen, but dual citizenship, Hungarian-American, who wants to aid. And give me a call back when you can. Thank you.
And then there was a pause, and he kind of stated under his breath to not talk until he hung up the phone.
Don't say anything right before.
And I heard him begin to discuss in a very different tone, actually, with his colleagues about what had just happened, what he wanted them to do, what their plan was going forward.
What needs to happen is someone other than me needs to make 100 phone calls like that.
Evidently, Victor Kesh thought that he'd already hung up the phone, and what Dana Garrity could hear was a group of men talking with him as they began to plot something for nearly 10 minutes.
So this situation, I just got a name.
Keep in mind, the quality is not that good because they're not actually talking into the phone. They don't realize they're being recorded.
Dana Lee Garrity, Open Society Foundation. There she is, Eurasia Program.
So Dana Garrity is a 28-year-old operations specialist who's overseeing pro-democracy programs in Eurasia for the Open Society Foundations. And evidently, the man who identified himself as Victor Kesh is trying to explain who she is to the rest of the group.
Just by making a phone call, I was able to understand who she is, I was able to understand her title, and I know that she deals with Hungary, Poland issues.
Victor Kesh wants Dana to call him back.
Probably going to call me back.
Now, if she doesn't call back, Kesh says, he can create other points of entry to get people in positions like Dana.
Now, even if she doesn't, I can create other points of entry to get people like that.
It's important to note that he's not targeting the president of the foundation. He's looking for points of entry with relatively low-level employees from whom he can work his way in and work his way up. So what is going on here, and who is Victor Kesh? The voicemail actually contains a number of clues, and if you follow them, the person you get to is James O'Keefe, a conservative activist who is infamous for doing secret videos that seek to embarrass liberal groups like NPR, Planned Parenthood, and his most successful operation so far was his takedown of Acorn, a liberal political organizing group.
Scenario: a young woman pretending to be a prostitute and a man pretending to run for Congress one day walk into Acorn's Baltimore headquarters and speak with two of the employees who run the facility.
As soon as the tape came out, it created a sensation in the media, particularly in the right-wing media, and not long after, Congress voted to cut off all federal funding to Acorn, and the group soon after collapsed.
Four Acorn employees have been fired. There are new calls on Capitol Hill for hearings into Acorn, and Acorn has been dropped from participating in the census next year.
It now appears that James O'Keefe's latest target is the Open Society Foundations and their creator, George Soros. As the voicemail continues, we hear James O'Keefe speaking with the other people in the room about some kind of questionable money operation.
Getting a meeting, you know, through a foundation that exists would be a good one. We're not going to do it with an offshore, you know, British Virgin Island company in this case, because Soros' people don't want to probably take money from a group like that.
He seems to be saying that they want to set up a compromising situation in which they entrap someone at the Soros Foundation into taking some money under dubious kinds of circumstances. But he's saying that probably the Soros Foundation won't take money from something obvious like a corporation that's registered in the British Virgin Islands. Instead, what he's looking for is something that seems like a plausible way to sort of set the Soros people up. He suggested that other liberal targets that they might go after would be crass enough to take that kind of money.
Hillary would.
Chelsea would.
Senator from American Progress would.
I don't think the Open Society would, he says. The Open Society Foundations were founded by George Soros. He is a liberal hedge fund billionaire who is one of the largest funders of Democratic and liberal politics in America, and he has become almost a boogeyman to some people on the right. So why did Viktor Keshe state twice that he's a Hungarian-American? And this kind of small detail seems key, too.
I think maybe the reason, I mean, this is just pure speculation, but perhaps the reason he chose a Hungarian identity is because George Soros is also of Hungarian descent and is a Hungarian-American.
So it seems almost designed to hook him in. At this point, the voicemail continues, and it gets a little weirder.
An hour ago, we spoke with my friend in Atlanta, who's the orthopedic surgeon.
What they're talking about, it seems, is importing an orthopedic surgeon from England who's visiting the country and is going to come up to where this sting is supposed to take place, evidently in New York, and help them out on it.
We'll train him, and he's more than happy to do anything he can do for us. He's got a real heavy British accent.
So this fellow from England is very technical, and he's not going to have any problem with the cameras.
He's very technical, so I'm sure he's not going to have any problem with the cameras.
He's a very talented guy, they say, and so he'll be able to pull it off.
And he's a very talented guy, so I mean, he'll be able to pull it off.
When I first called James O'Keefe, asking if he had any idea who Viktor Keshe was, he acted like he was mystified. He said, "Viktor Keshe? Viktor Keshe?" And then he said he had no interest in discussing this or talking about any investigations or operations that were, as he put it, real or imagined. But when I kept reporting and made clear to him that I actually had a copy of the tape of his phone call, he then decided to put the best face on it and publicly confess.
"We had a plan to go undercover into the Soros Foundation to expose their questionable activities. We posed as a Hungarian investor named Viktor and eventually connected with Dana Garrity, a program specialist at the foundation. We were hoping for a meeting. She called us back and left a message."
"Hi, Viktor. This is Dana Garrity giving you a call back. I got your voicemail."
But the Soros people were able to thwart our plan.
So this time, O'Keefe got caught trying to sting George Soros, one of the most important funders and players on the liberal side of American politics. He said he had to fold the operation, and he apologized to his supporters for the embarrassment. But in the end, he also noted that he's got many more operations that are still ongoing. And he's also got, he says, dozens and dozens of other operatives out there in the field looking for the next get.
"What needs to happen is someone other than me needs to make 100 phone calls like that."
For the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'm Jane Mayer.
This weekend, young people all across the country are going to graduate with as much pomp and circumstance as they can muster. One of those graduates is a guy named David Carroll. Carroll is a long-serving veteran of the Army, a former tank commander who retired and then applied to Vassar College. Now, Vassar is like the quintessential small, artsy, liberal Northeastern school, and going there was almost a lark, the way David Carroll tells it. When he got there, he befriended one of his professors, Hua Xu, who's also a contributor to The New Yorker.
"Typical Vassar student, that's almost an oxymoron, because the campus prides itself in being really diverse, really welcoming, really open-minded, pretty liberal slash progressive campus vibe, a lot of interest in social justice. It's very, very gay-friendly."
"My name's David Carroll. I'm 35 years old. And I'm a senior at Vassar College now. Before coming to Vassar College, I was in the Army for 11 and a half years and spent 4 years deployed to Iraq as a 19-kilo tank commander."
"Have a great weekend, and we have 6 more presentations on Tuesday."
"You know, I am a Republican, and I'm a Texas Republican."
In fall of 2013, Dave Carroll was one of 3 veterans who enrolled in my freshman writing class as part of the Posse Veterans Program at Vassar College. But what did you know about Vassar?"
"I knew nothing about Vassar. nothing. A buddy of mine said, hey, man, he called me one day. He's like, hey, you know, Vassar College is looking for veterans. You should apply. I said, is it a good school? He said, yeah. I said, done. Let's apply. And then I said, well, where the hell is Vassar at? You know, I was like, I've never heard of that. So I Googled it and looked at the library, and I was like, looks good. Let's try that. Let's go to a woman's college full of Democrats. Awesome.
Actually, Vassar went co-ed in 1969, but the reputation lingers on.
I've always wondered this. So, like I've told you in the past, I didn't really know that we had this program before showing up that first day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like you get pictures of all your students. And I remember printing out the pictures for your class, and I'm walking to school, and I look down and I see a guy who's like my age, his head shaved. But I remember you were also wearing a t-shirt with like the GOP elephant on it.
Yeah.
Did you do that on purpose?
Oh yeah, you gotta represent. You know, can't just let all the liberals think they're getting over on everybody. You know, if I'm the guy with the Republican shirt on whenever the teachers print out their little things, you know, at least then they know that they're gonna have to address that issue at some point. You know, and it forces them to be honest a little bit more so.
It totally worked for me. I mean, what was your impression of Vassar kids when you started?
I was impressed. It took a good, you know, almost a whole first year just to be able to articulate my thoughts the way that they did. You know, so in the military, the more I cussed, the faster I get promoted. So that was, you know, that's just how you talked. You know, so it was just a different language. So you had to, you know, you had to learn a different language when you came here just so that you could be able to get your point across. So my first impression of these students were, holy, these kids are smart.
I remember having to remind Dave and the other veterans that they were smart too, just in a different way, maybe a little rough around the edges. But I wondered if he was ever bothered with being around so many young college students.
You know, so it wasn't so much dealing with 18 and 19-year-olds at college here, because I dealt with 18 and 19-year-olds all the time. There was a little bit difference where I couldn't just scream at them and make them do push-ups. You know, I wish I could have done that a few times. But there's times where I walk through and I just hear a really ignorant conversation of, you know, just not ignorant, just, you know, no experience, no life experience conversation going on somewhere. And, you know, and I just think, you know, what it's like to be 19 again and try to figure it out.
I was doing an independent study with Dave, and, you know, we just sort of, there was no actual final assignment. So I just said, look, you've mentioned in the past wanting to write about your experiences. Just write me, you know, 5 or 6 pages and that'll be it.
I mean, I have files and files of just stuff that, you know, just because I don't sleep well some nights, you know, so whenever I'm thinking about it, I just go try to write it just to get it down and out.
He sent me a document. It was one of the most disturbing things I've ever read.
You know, I mean, I revisit it a lot just in my own mind. You know, it plays all the time in my own mind.
And part of it was because I think he was aware of how disturbing it was.
You know, I have tons and tons of just gibberish written, but so far they've just been going into a file on my computer that says veteran shit.
This was just an account of combat, of life as a soldier, of destruction that was unlike anything I'd ever read or seen.
You know, you have highlights that you look back on your life. Some of my highlights are just happen to be really horrible things happening.
And when he turned the paper in, he included this note. Don't worry, man, I'm not a monster anymore. Ha ha. I've come to grips with my past. It's hard to tell my story of civilians.
Because the first thing most of them think is, he likes killing. I wonder if he still wants to. War is a different place. Those actions are acceptable there. I have boxes full of medals from acting like that. They're all in my attic to be seen again whenever I move. I'm not proud of a lot of things I did while I was deployed, but I'm damn sure not ashamed of any of them. Most of the people I know now in my life know I was in the Army, but few of them know what you know now. If this paper has to be seen by anyone other than you, let me know so I can write you something else. This is for your eyes only. See you next semester.
Typically when I meet with students, I can kind of rely on being older than them to have a tiny bit more wisdom than them. With these guys, there was no age difference, and their life experiences were really different from mine. I didn't feel like I had that much to offer other than just as someone who's willing to listen to them and take them seriously. What was the experience actually like?
Of being in a tank?
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say it's miserable, but it's pretty miserable, and it's incredibly hot. So whenever you're, you know, in August in Iraq, it's 110 outside, it's 125 in the tank, you know, so it gets to be miserable. And there's a lot of times where you did 24-hour ops, so you went out there and sat for 24 hours in one spot and just kind of scanned. And after a while, it'd feel like your brain is literally melting because it was just so unbearable.
So over 11 years, you were in Iraq for like 4.5 years?
Yeah, four.
4 years. How many firefights were you involved in?
A lot. I would say that I pulled the triggers, you know, around about 300 times. I think the best I can gauge IEDs that went off on my vehicle or near my vehicle is 32.
Like, what do you do to kind of keep it together? Are you just sort of anticipating the next rush?
Yeah, you're just anticipating the next rush because it can happen at any second. You kind of just sit in there and just talk and listen to the radio.
What were you listening to?
Like Puddle of Mud, Let the Bodies Hit the Floor.
Let the bodies hit the floor. Let the bodies hit the floor.
It was on somebody's iPod, but Let the Bodies Hit the Floor, man. You listen to that and just wait for the kickoff. And you just be in the tunnel waiting for him to call your name.
Like you would just listen to that one song over and over?
I mean, that was the theme of it. You know, so if you had to put a theme song to the war in Iraq, it would be that. You know, everybody had their own taste, but in my tank, it was nasty heavy metal.
Do you still listen to those songs now?
No, I can't listen to them anymore.
You know, up until this point, I felt like I had a pretty good understanding of him. And what really shocked me about what he sent me was just how it seemed as though he actually would have wanted to go back.
So I missed the adrenaline of it. You know, it's the fear, the excitement, the pain. If you get to engage with the enemy at close range, it's like the best challenge that you can have in your life. And then on the other side of that is when it doesn't go right and it's really bad. So then you can go into the rest of your life knowing that it'll never, ever be as worse as war. But there's also a little bit of it that you're never going to feel again, that you're going to miss.
I think what troubled me was the honesty, was his recognition that this was a part of who he was. I just felt really humbled. And I also just felt in awe that this guy had done all of these things, and now I was somehow responsible for him.
Even I remember going to your office the first semester and just looking around in your office and be like, oh yeah, this is the exact same, you know, you got the West Coast vibe on it, but you know, this is the exact same stuff that I have. You know, I was like, this is awesome because it's just random 90s things thrown in there, you know, just like you had a Master P doll.
One thing that I think is really important to note is that these guys weren't the type to sit around and swap war stories. In fact, Dave told us that before coming to Vassar, he'd been part of a veterans group at his previous school, and he had put up a sign on the first day that said, only one war story per day. He just wasn't really the type who wanted to live in the past. When I interviewed Dave, one of the producers I worked with asked if he could read a copy of Dave's essay, if he'd be willing to share it. Dave basically said, no. You haven't earned the right yet. And that got me thinking. You just said that, like, someone you don't know needs to, like, earn the right to access your stories. Why did you think I deserve to read? I mean, I know I assigned you something,
you have,
but, like,
a Master P doll in your room, dude. You know, I mean, it doesn't take a whole lot. You know, it just has to be somebody that you can connect with, that you know it's not just going to be that's open-minded enough to see those things and say, well, that's really not who he is. That's just some of the things that has, you know, he's been involved in. I think that's
it's all because of the Master P doll.
it all rolls around the Master P doll.
It's crazy that you... I barely remember that I have that doll in my... I mean, it's because I have so much in my office, but... I mean, did you think, though, when we started, like, our class, that I would end up earning that right?
No, because you were... I think you were the first professor that I had. I think you were the very, very first class that I'd taken at Vassar. You know, so... And then here comes, you know, the stereotypical Northeast professor, you know? And I was like, oh... Look at this guy. Then after, you know, the third or fourth class, I think that's when I was like, hey, man, this guy gets it. You know, he understands what's, you know, all of this kind of looks like a little bit.
That first month, all three of you guys had a lot of challenges and you would come talk to me and I would feel really bad. But then after a while, I was like, I can't just, feeling bad doesn't really do anything. I can't just like have pity for these guys.
Yeah. And none of us want that. We just don't know what we're doing.
Like, how do you think being here has changed your sense of, like, politics or just sort of how you see the world or...
So, I've always had a moderate conservative viewpoint, always. Yeah. And, you know, I just think that as far as what's really changed me from being here is knowing that the left and the right aren't that far off. But almost every single person that's here could be just categorized in the middle. You know, I don't think it matters if you got an elephant or the donkey on your shirt. I don't think it really matters.
So at the end of this month, Dave and his fellow liberal Northeastern 20-somethings will be walking as part of Vassar's 2016 graduating class. He himself doesn't seem particularly interested in this ritual, but his mom and grandma are coming all the way to Poughkeepsie, and they're so proud they really want to see him cross that stage. We've talked about what he might do in the future. He's mentioned the possibility of getting an MBA, maybe law school. You know, I've thought maybe he should write a book.
So as far as I've gotten now is I bought a house near Fort Worth so that I have the possibility to go to A&M Law. So I thought try to go to law school and see where that leads me.
So Dave's got a lot of options, but in a way I don't think he's that different from a lot of the 20-somethings he'll be walking with. They've acquired a lot of knowledge, they've learned a lot about themselves, but at this point, they don't really know what they want to do next.
It's just that I want to go spend some time in my pool and float underneath the shade for a few years and figure out what I want to do with life. So I really don't know yet.
David Carroll, a U.S. Army veteran and a newly minted graduate of Vassar College, talking with The New Yorker's Hua Xu. Speaking of graduation, we're going to hear now a commencement speech for the graduates of the future. This is To the Class of 2050 by Jen Spira.
Class of 2050, faculty, alumni, family, and friends. I remember when I sat where you sit today. The year was 2020. The fires from the impact still smoldered in their craters. Madonna's Dance Dance Boom Boom had just hit the airwaves. Athleisure was bigger than ever, and it seemed like everyone I knew was either dead or enslaved by the tall ones. I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. A couple of friends were talking about combing the wreckage for survivors, and a couple of other friends were talking about combing the wreckage for food. Meanwhile, my boyfriend was begging me to come with him to Chicago to do improv. I didn't know where to start. I had no money, no flint, and no plan. Sure, I had a bachelor's degree in English, but what was I going to do with that? Plus, like many survivors, I no longer had skin on my face or my hands. Luckily, it didn't take me long to learn that there's only one thing you have to worry about, and that's following your passion. If you do what you love, you'll never work a day in your life. Maybe you're passionate about making spears, or cudgels, or daggers to fend off our oversized invaders. Perhaps you're more interested in nunchucks, or spikes, or clamps. Whatever it is, simply follow your interest and have at it. If you take away anything from this speech, let it be this. Success doesn't mean having a big house or a fancy corner office. There's only one true measure of success, and that's how close you can get to deciphering the Mayan hieroglyph that will show humanity how to defeat the Tall Ones. When I was your age, I had big plans. I was going to find the glyph, I was going to decode it, and free my fellow humans from our tragic captivity. But then, you know what happened? I fell in love with long-form journalism. I met the love of my life at USC, we had two beautiful children, and eventually, being humanity's savior fell by the wayside. Do I have regrets? Sometimes. The Tall Ones tore my husband and my children apart in front of my eyes. As I listened to their screams, did I wish that I put in a little more glyph time? Sure, I made mistakes. That's called being human. Remember, life is 10% what happens to you, 10% how you respond to it, and 80% how good your reflexes are when the Tall Ones come at your throat with their pinchers. Today, you guys are going to be awarded diplomas. You've earned it. But remember that a diploma's just a piece of paper. What really matters is what you do with that piece of paper. And I strongly recommend burning it to ward off the Tall Ones, for they fear an open flame. Thank you, and good luck.
Words of wisdom for apocalyptic times. That was To the Class of 2050 by Jen Spira, performed for us by Rachel Dratch. I'm David Remnick. You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Ross Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where hundreds of researchers make new discoveries inspired by the work of previous Dana-Farber scientists. Learn more about their momentum at danafarber.org/everywhere.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Lena Dunham is the creator of Girls, our preeminent show about 20-somethings. But she herself just turned 30. Dunham is also a diehard supporter of Hillary Clinton, so there's lots to talk about.
I don't mind the idea of having somebody who's a member of the establishment, because guess what? The government is an establishment, and there needs to be somebody who understands how to navigate it. But also, if all I wanted was a female in the White House, why wouldn't I have been running around behind, you know, Sarah Palin fixing her skirts?
That's next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour. A presidential election is a moment when we choose not so much a politician, but a leader, or ideally so. And every so often, the choice between candidates looks like a choice between entirely different definitions of leadership. Leadership is even an obsession. It's an entire industry with God knows how many books published on the subject. And a couple of months ago, The New Yorker's Josh Rothman started thinking about this obsession and what it tells us.
I got really fascinated by the question of what leadership was, and I started out by reading a lot of leadership books. Of all the books I read, the most interesting was an anthology edited by an English professor named Elizabeth Sammet, who teaches at the United States Military Academy at West Point.
When I first got here, I used to see a fellow who works in landscaping here, and we'd pass almost every day, and I'd wave to him on his mower, and he'd wave to me. And then one day he stopped, and he said, "What's your function? What do you do here?" And I said, and this was early on, and I said, "Well, I teach English," and that's really how I thought of it.
She teaches English at a place where everyone wears a uniform and calls her ma'am.
Ma'am, section formed, missing one, Cadet Silverman.
Each of her students, each cadet, is training to be a military leader.
As I was here longer and had a greater connection with lieutenants and captains, and now even a few majors who are my former students, I realized the role that studying English plays in their lives. They will write and say, I was thinking about my reading of Coriolanus or of Henry V or Richard II before a mission when I was going to tell my soldiers what we had to do and how I believed in them. Another example would be actually one of my current colleagues who flew Kiowa helicopters in Afghanistan. And we had talked for a long time about Antoine de Saint-Exupéry's writings. And he said, obviously, the aircraft that Saint-Exupéry flew were so different from mine. And yet, he would read what Exupéry has to say about personal responsibility and responsibility to one's fellow pilots. And that really struck a chord with my former student when he found himself in Afghanistan.
Saint-Exupéry isn't included in Zammit's anthology, but she does include a lot of surprising stuff. The book has a lot of poetry. It has diary entries. It has some pieces you'd expect, Machiavelli or Clausewitz, classic writers on leadership, but it also has writings by Virginia Woolf and even Zadie Smith. It really seems like Zammit is determined to look at leadership from every possible angle.
Every day, just in the course of my job, I had to keep asking myself, what does good leadership look like? And we're required to write evaluations all the time, and those evaluations ask you to talk about their leadership potential. And at first I thought, how do I know what their leadership? I don't know. I know whether they can scan a line of poetry, or I know whether they understand Shakespeare, but I don't know if they're going to be good leaders or not. What does that mean?
I'm Cadet Brian Silverman. I'm from outside of Philadelphia.
Zammit introduced me to a student of hers, a senior who's studying international relations. When Brian's done at West Point in a few months, he'll go to Fort Benning for boot camp.
So I'll be an infantry officer for 4 years before transitioning into military intelligence. And I'll be posting to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, with the 101st Airborne Division.
Wow. Are you excited?
Yeah, absolutely.
Brian told me that he'd gone to a Quaker school throughout his childhood, and that part of the reason he decided to go to West Point was because he'd read The Chosen, a novel by Chaim Potok, which crystallized his belief in simple service and commitment to values. Zammit says he's already a leader among his peers.
There are certain cadets who, even as freshmen, sort of show this, I don't know, this particular facility for, maybe they're very attuned to the other people around them, what their preoccupations are, a certain attentiveness, that focus and that kind of tenacity. I think those are important elements as well.
And Zammit sees her literature class as a place where those leaderly qualities in Brian and other cadets can grow.
I think that reflection and careful study that the classroom encourages helps. It helps with self-awareness. It helps with an awareness of others. But I also think there's sort of an element of luck or chance involved in it all. I mean, if you're placed in a particular circumstance at a particular moment, perhaps all of those faculties, perhaps all of whatever it is you've been thinking about and you didn't realize it was leadership, then suddenly becomes an opportunity to show this.
I asked Brian about how he was learning to be a leader at West Point, and he told me a kind of story that I wasn't expecting to hear.
Yeah, I guess I'll say this, even though it's sort of a professionally embarrassing moment for me.
One of the capstone experiences at West Point is something called CLDT, which stands for Cadet Leadership Development Training, field exercises.
For, you know, a period of 7-8 days, something like that. Blank rounds, executing a whole wide variety of missions.
When I asked Brian if he was in charge of other cadets during that time, he clarified. He wasn't in charge of them, he said. He was responsible for them.
I had done really well. I had been very diligent. The missions that I had been in charge of as the platoon leader were successful. My patrols were good. But there I was on the last night, literally hours from finishing this huge graduation requirement, which a lot of cadets sort of think of as the bane of their existence. And I was cleaning my weapon, and still I really don't understand how this happened, but there was a round inside the chamber. I was doing a functions test. The point is I had a negligent discharge of my weapon. And this is one of the most catastrophic things that can occur, because it shows that you don't have control over your most important tool, and more that your negligence has risked the lives potentially of the people around you. In a patrol base in the middle of the night, you know, you give away your position, everyone around you could die.
Now, what makes this a leadership story is what Brian did next. He walked over to the person in command and told him what had happened. He faced the consequences.
And he sat me down and gave me one of the like hardest hitting talks that I have ever had. He and the NCOs that were around him explained to me that, you know, even though I had done well, a mistake like this, it would destroy my career, but far more importantly, risk the lives of the people around me. And I think the reason that this was so important, the reason that it was so impactful, was that at no other time in my experience as a cadet had the real Army deployment, at no point had they felt more real. You know, I looked someone else in the eyes who had been there and had them tell me, you made this error. This is unacceptable. You need to fix this. Still, I think about it all the time.
And I found myself thinking about Brian's story too. When pundits and politicians talk about leadership, a lot of times they seem to be talking about something different, about who's in charge, who's the toughest, or alternatively, who's to blame. There's a disconnect between the real-life leadership that Brian's talking about and the spectacle of leadership that we watch on television. I think that's what Samet was trying to puzzle out when she was putting together her anthology.
The narrative of crisis is very seductive. In this vacuum of leadership, I'm your next leader. So if there's no vacuum, then you don't need me. And so there's this idea that I think people imagine leadership as something they can see. And you can see it in a crisis because someone has to rush in and do something very dramatic. But I think a lot of good leadership happens silently. It happens not in moments of crisis. That's my concern about this romance of crisis, because you need people to lead when things are going fine or okay or before they collapse. And yet that's not a particularly romantic kind of leadership. It's not a particularly appealing kind of leadership. In the military, it's the difference between peacetime leadership and leadership in war.
Yeah.
And what I try to emphasize with my students is that peacetime leadership is just as important. And you don't win medals for it. I mean, it's hard to measure leaders by all of the actions they didn't take.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, in the long run, that's often what really matters. But it's such a hard thing conceptually to get excited about.
I really learned something from Samet and Brian about leadership. If you watch political debates on TV, they seem to focus exclusively on the qualities of wartime leadership. They're so often about being aggressive, tough, and intimidating. You never see the other half, the peacetime half of leadership. It's ironic, I think, that if you want to learn about peacetime leadership, you have to turn off the television and go to the United States Military Academy at West Point. And I love Samet's definition of leadership, that leaders are responsible, restrained, attentive, focused, concerned, even a little frightened of the consequences of their actions, that they've been tempered by real-world experience that's left them compassionate and self-aware, and that those qualities make it possible for them to be creative, ambitious, and daring when there really is a crisis.
Josh Rothman of The New Yorker. He spoke with Elizabeth Samet, a professor of English at West Point. At newyorkerradio.org, you can sign up for our newsletter, and we'll let you know what's on the show and all of our podcasts, fiction and poetry and politics, lots of good stuff. That's it for this week, though. We'll be back next week with Lena Dunham and Baratunda Thurston, who talks about working on and leaving The Daily Show. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for joining me.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Owen Agnew, Alex Barron, Becky Cooper, Matt Fidler, Trey Kay, Rick Kwan, and Josh Rogerson. Special thanks this week to Andy Lancet, the Director of Archives at New York Public Radio. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.